was a meltdown that happened somewhere. Poison the earth, water and air. But it isn't news with the TV or press, 'cause that was the week of Lady Gaga's new dress. Antiquities being destroyed in Iraq. Children are starving from U.S. attack. But we never gave it one minute thought, 'cause that was the week John Edwards got caught. Telecom industry caught up in spying. Bush and Obama caught up in lying. State Department war is inciting.
From Colorado and today, Falls Church, Virginia, welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and we're a proud member of the Coffee Party USA Network. And today, we're going to have, I've already recorded it, you guys know how this works, but we have a wonderful conversation with Richard McCormick, and he is with a publication called Manufacturing and Technology News, and that's distributed through manufacturingnews.com. And we're kind of going to do a follow-up story on the discussion with retired four-star general Ann Dunwoody's appearance on the show. And she made a comment about she was in charge of the entire U.S. Army's global supply chain. And the military is getting very concerned about outsourcing U.S. manufacturing of defense contracts, meaning that we're not our industrial base has deteriorated to the point where we now have to go overseas to fulfill U.S. defense issues and systems. And so Richard McCormick and I are going to talk about that. And it's a very important conversation. And we do kind of go on to other areas that I think that you'll find interesting about Trans-Pacific Partnership and just basic economics. He's a good guy. It's the first time I've met him, and I think you're going to like him too. Again, his name is Richard McCormick, and you can find out more about him at manufacturingnews.com. But first, as I'm apt to do, what I want to do is talk about some other things. And what I want to do, and I'm going to ask you to kind of stay with me on this, is talk about three different articles and bring it together to one thing. And let's start with the first article that was recently published, just government data that was released about the gross domestic product, and it actually shrunk. Our economy shrunk in the first quarter, but just like Walmart's quarterly reports, nobody gets too concerned about it. But what's happened is the economy is reduced, and they say it's due to weather. They say it's due to whatever, maybe lower price of oil, who knows. But just any number of reasons. They say the gross domestic product, the economic growth, shrunk a little bit in the first quarter as compared to last year. But they also acknowledge that they'll revise it later. And I don't know what the black box of revisions are, but something will happen. So anyway, we have negative growth. And then another article came out in the Wall Street Journal, and it talks about how high-priced housing starts are up, but nobody's really excited about it, and how the price of homes, existing homes, is going way up. And it was really interesting. I'll just read a comment from the Wall Street Journal from May 27th. It said, while April was one of the strongest new home sales reports since 2008, taking a longer view, it was weak. In the 1990s, when the population was about one-fifth lower than now, meaning we have about 320 million Americans now, and 20% lower than that would be about 270 million or so. But back in the 90s, with the smaller population, the country averaged about 700,000 new homes sold each year. And now we're just at 484,000, that rate. And so what's happened over the past year, about 12 existing homes are sold for every new home sold. And that does not compare well with 6 homes sold. Existing homes sold for every new home in 1999. All right, here I am getting into that Tim Danahy numbers kind of thing. But what's happening is nobody's selling their houses, and we're really buying houses at a very slow rate, even compared to 20 years ago. And so the average price of a house, the median price, let's do that. The median price means half the houses cost more, half the houses cost less. The median price for a home over the last year is now about $290,000, and that's about 37% higher than the $211,000 median price for a new home. But what's happened in, so it's a lot higher, but back in the 90s, it was a lot closer. So what's happening is that the median price for a new home now has reached more than four times the median family income. All right, here I am going crazy with all these numbers, and you hate numbers. And I hate talking about numbers. You hate listening to them. But what's happening is the prices of homes are going up, and incomes are not going up. So what's happening is people aren't selling their homes because they can't afford to move, and people can't buy homes because the new homes are too expensive. And it's turning into a big mess. And so the median home price has climbed 9% over last year, and that is more than four times faster than hourly wage growth. And so we look at this, and so the home builders are wondering, they're kind of like the canary in the economic mine shaft. Why aren't people buying what I have? The prices keep going up. We have an attractive product, but no, used homes, you know, there's a huge demand for those. Why aren't people buying their homes? Well, they're too expensive. Nobody's making any money. And so those are two of the stories that we've tied together. Now let's tie the third story into this. And this is a report that I'm going to be reading from a story from Forbes magazine. And it has the headline, the story is based on Bureau of Labor statistics that have just come out, and it's under the U.S. General Accounting Office. But the story in Forbes is entitled, Shocker, 40% of workers now have contingent jobs, says the U.S. government. Now, to come up with that 40% of all workers in the United States have contingent jobs. And that would be like temporaries at agencies, workers that are on call, meaning they only go to work when the employers say they're needed. These are contract company workers, meaning they have like a limited time of work, and then they have to go out look for another job. We're talking about independent contractors who do something, and then they have to go out and look for their own customers. It's not a job. It's kind of self-employed individual. It also includes self-employed workers, such as a small retail shop owner or a small restaurant owner, and it also includes part-time workers in America. And it all adds up to over 40% of American workers, approaching half of American workers, have contingent jobs. And we tie that back to why aren't people with contingent jobs able to buy new homes? Why is the economy contracting? Well, maybe we're starting to get at the gist of it here. In 2005, 30% of workers were contingent. And so it has just gone up in just 5 years, it's gone up 36%. And it's because employers don't want to pay benefits. They don't want to offer job securities. They just want to use people as they need them. And so I'm going to quote a couple lines here from the Forbes article. It says, the report uses data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And I quote, it begs an important question. Are traditional jobs, the foundation of our consumer economy, running their course and going the way of the typewriter and the 8-track tape? And if so, what do we do about it? If you want to know what to do about it, listen to my conversation with Richard Wolff from about 2 weeks ago that does talk about that issue. It's changing. But the Forbes magazine article goes on to say, the report is important because it's the first time since the Great Recession that the U.S. government has taken stock of how many people are working without protections that come with traditional full-time W-2 jobs. And Senators Patty Murray of Washington and Kirsten Gillibrand of New York write, and I quote, "Because contingent work can be unstable or may afford fewer protections, depending on a worker's particular employment arrangement, it tends to lead to lower earnings, fewer benefits, and a greater reliance on public assistance than standard work." And then the Forbes magazine article report goes on to say, as reports point out, contingent workers often lack employer-provided benefits such as health insurance and access to government safety net traditional W-2 workers have when their work dries up, meaning unemployment insurance. If you're self-employed or contingent, you get unemployed, you don't have anything. What's even more tragic about this whole situation is that 16.8% of contingent workers have college educations. That's tragic. So when you take a look at all the contingent workers, here's some of the issues that contingent workers have that Congress and America doesn't seem to want to address. Whenever you're a contingent worker, you have a higher poverty rate. You know, most full-time workers have a living wage. I won't even say a living wage, a better wage. But only about a third of contingent workers have a decent wage. If you take a look at what the wages are, the low pay, contingent workers had a median hourly earning, median, I mean half or more, half or less, of $11.95. Whereas people with full-time jobs had a standard, had a median hourly rate of $17. So you take a look at that. And the report says, reflecting on the fact that many contingent workers are involuntary part-timers and can't always get work when they want it, the median annual earnings, half more, half less, but the median annual earnings of a contingent worker was $14,963 compared to $35,000 for full-time workers. Tragic. It's just tragic. When you're a contingent worker, the jobs are more unstable. About 29% of all contingent workers said they were laid off in the past year, compared to 18% of independent contractors were laid off in the last year. But only 8% of standard full-time workers and 6% of part-time workers were laid off. Somebody is using these people and they're not paying for them. You know, with this kind of economic growth that we're supposed to be having, there should be jobs for people. These people that are contingent workers have less access to health insurance. And as Walmart often typifies, that whenever you're a contingent worker, you don't have this satisfactory income. You have a higher reliance on public assistance, and the people have to pay for it. So the report concludes, and I tip my hat to Forbes magazine. Another trend the report underlines is the fading of good blue-collar jobs, traditionally a source of stable middle-class jobs for men. It's increasingly becoming contingent work assigned through agencies. Now, this is the kind of stuff that just begs to say, you want the economy to grow. You want an economy that's based on people spending to grow. You want to sell houses. What you need to do is to create the jobs. And the jobs are out there, but employers are parsing them out to get them cheap and to not pay benefits. And this is really another case for the need to have a stronger union representation in this country. We just need to have economic justice also. So when we come back from break, we're going to be talking sort of about this, but it talks about how we're outsourcing high-tech defense contracting jobs even. Even those are going to lower-priced nations and nations that spend more on R&D. It's going to scare the living daylights out of you. It's an interesting conversation coming up. It's a conversation that needs to be heard, and this conversation ties in with the TPP. So you're going to want to hear more about it after the break. You're listening to the Tim Danhey Show. We'll be right back.
Reading your mail, Aaron Schwartz is suicidal, but everyone's watching American Idol. That was the week more families died. Drones in the skies commit genocide. the side. Oh, that was the week they could have been saved, but there wasn't room for a mother.
Teddy Roosevelt said, of all forms of tyranny, the least attractive and the most vulgar is the tyranny of mere wealth. This is why antitrust law and competition is essential to America's economic health. This is why the Organization for Competitive Markets works to reclaim competition for farmers, ranchers, and rural communities across America. We believe our duty is to advocate a just role for government in the agricultural economy, an enforcer of rules necessary for markets that are fair, honest, and accessible. The Organization for Competitive Markets. Learn more at competitivemarkets.com.
The Fukushima radiation is reaching.
You preserve a nation one community at a time, with shared knowledge and an informed electorate, with many voices speaking with civility and integrity. And we will preserve our nation when we participate, we learn, we discuss, we vote. We are the Coffee Party USA. Join us today. CoffeePartyUSA.com.
Afghanistan's looking like El Salvador. Plutonium is leaking in Paducah, Kentucky. While you scratch a card to see if you're lucky.
You hear the music we're playing here on the Tim Danahy Show? We like to feature socially aware music by independent artists across the country. So if you have music or you know a musician who would like us to feature their songs, contact us through Danahy.com. Send us an MP3 version or a link, a little bit about you and permission to use it on the show. And we'll listen. We'll try to feature it and we'll post your link for everyone to see. Music is a part of the Tim Danahy Show community. We'd love for you to be that part here at Danahy.com.
To make our cell phones, mercury in your teeth, fluoride in your bones. Life is saying that our food causes cancers, but that was the week of the stars and their dancers.
Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and we're a proud member of the Coffee Party USA Network. And we recently had retired U.S. Army 4-star General Ann Dunwoody on the show, and it was a good conversation. And we discussed a number of really interesting issues. But among those issues was a comment of hers, and it's in her book. And please understand that Ann Dunwoody was in charge of $60 billion annual budget for the U.S. Army's global supply chain. But her comment was about the military's concern about America's declining industrial base and outsourcing they're outsourcing essential Defense Department systems and supplies to foreign countries. And she said the problem has gotten a lot worse over the past 12 years. And this brings up some odd contradictions in U.S. military policy, our foreign policy, and even our trade policies. And I wanted to discuss this issue with an expert. So I contacted Richard McCormick, who produces a publication called Manufacturing and Technology News, which is distributed through manufacturingnews.com. So, Richard, welcome to the Tim Danahy Show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, you do some really interesting work. I'm so thankful of the people who put me in contact with you, and because the stuff is important, and really you're kind of cutting edge. So I'm hoping that listeners appreciate what you have here. But in your May 20th publication, it says that the United States defense sector is in its fourth stage of development. Can you tell me what this is all about? It's important.
Yeah, well, you know, the first stage, I guess, was all up till World War II, where the government controlled the means of production. They had arsenals, and they produced all the weaponry. So that's the first stage. The second went up to, they had big defense integrators like General Motors and GE. Big companies got into the defense game and stayed in the defense game, and that lasted up until about 1993 at the end of the Cold War. Then we scaled back, we had the peace dividend, and all the defense divisions within those big companies got consolidated. So that was phase three. Now we're entering a fourth phase. This is a new epic, and this one is defined by the fact that DOD's budgets are going down, the world is globalized, the big companies have globalized, we've stopped investing in R&D in this country, and not stopped. We're not growing investment in R&D. And now the government, having seen that the defense industrial base was dependent upon the regular U.S. industrial base has gone global. The defense industrial base now is dependent on foreign suppliers for its technology, and it's not driving technology. So now DOD is in a new world order where they have to figure out how to take advantage of technology that's being developed everywhere else, save for the United States, because most of our big companies are global, and they're doing a lot of their R&D overseas. And most of our competitors and big industrial competitors are also global companies or foreign companies, and they control the means of production. So our DOD is now entering a new era. How does it take advantage of foreign technology? How does it integrate foreign technology into its systems? Well, and that's perplexing to a lot of people in the military. It's perplexing to political people as well. I mean, so there are a lot of political issues, a lot of societal issues, a lot of economic issues at play here. Certainly, jobs are at play, but the strategic nature of technology, do you trust foreign technology? I mean, so much of the high-tech industry has shifted offshore. So we're buying so much from China. Does the military know the systems that it has with embedded within its bigger systems? Do they know the source of that technology? And there are just a lot of issues that are being raised by this whole, issue of globalization and outsourcing.
Well, Richard, what I want to do is get into kind of like the numbers involved with this, just so I can understand what's going on, and then I want to come back and get into what the consequences might be. But in your article in Manufacturing Technology News, you said that the U.S. defense industry has fallen from 12% of GDP to about 3.5% of GDP today, and I look at the papers and the federal budgets and things like that, and I'm saying, boy, with all the military expenditures seemingly going up and up, that seems counterintuitive. Can you explain that one to me?
Well, so it seems like they're going up, but they're not. They're actually going down. And what is going up, though, within the military budget itself are personnel costs, the cost of health care, the cost of the pensions. So the personnel costs are going up, but the amount that's spent on armaments and R&D and equipment, that's holding steady or going down. That's where they're taking all the money out of the budget. And when you look at that number, it's probably, if DOD's number, I don't have it right in front of me, but if it's somewhere around $600 billion, say, so much of that is for fuel and for logistics. It's really only like $160 billion or a small fraction, or a fraction, is going into the armaments, is going into equipment, is going into new technology, is going into R&D. So if you look at the total size of our economy of about $17 trillion and the amount that's being spent on DOD's weaponry, the hardware, at $200 billion, say, at the high end, or maybe more, it might be a little bit more, I'm not sure. But it's still a small segment of our total economy. So, and what they are spending isn't coming out of the defense industry. It's coming out of the civilian industry. So they're dependent on that civilian industry, the R&D that's being put into the civilian industry. They're not putting a lot into the R&D as much as they were. That's where they're having to cut in order to make up for the cost of war and the cost of personnel. Those are the big chunks of the military budget. So, we can all worry about, way too much money being spent on defense, but so much of that is on personnel and logistics and getting people over into the war zone but not really a lot. It is a lot relative to the overall economy. In the global economy, certainly, it's really a small amount.
Well, I look at that, and I was kind of amazed. First of all, I want to appraise you for just saying, you know, I put a pencil to the paper too, literally. You know, I guess I'm old school, and I was kind of going through the same numbers, and I came up with that same 160 billion you did using some baseline assumptions. So I was kind of able to get a context on everything. But you said something else that really kind of worked against my incomplete thinking, and I need to understand this. The article states that there's less competition for military production, which would imply fewer big contractors, and you use the term legacy contractors. But yet the share of contracts given to legacy defense contractors fell from about 3/4 from 73% in 2002 to 57% in 2011. So, Richard, I'm getting kind of all geeky and numerical on the radio and everything. I want to avoid it. But what's happening here, it seems like, okay, if they're consolidating the number of contractors and less competition, but they're getting a smaller piece of the pie, that means that the rest of the pie is either going to small businesses or overseas, and I know small businesses aren't getting it. So is this how much we're losing?
All those numbers will just baffle you.
Okay.
Just baffle you. But no, yes, there's a concentration. Because there are fewer platforms, there are not as many aircraft systems being developed. There's basically one, that's a Joint Strike Fighter. There are not many naval systems being developed. There's the Osprey. There's just no very few new helicopters, not many new space systems. So the number of contractors that have the capability to do that is very restricted now. So you don't have big competitions for big new platforms. So that kind of restricts the number of competitive types of awards that you're going to give, just because there are only so many American companies that can actually perform those. There are just not that many new platforms and very few that are proposed. But there are, the spending is going into other areas, and it's like cyber. There's a huge amount of spending going into cyber, and that doesn't go to the traditional contractors. The IT systems and communication systems and space networking systems. So, you know, that's a greater portion of the budget in terms of the procurement numbers. So, though there are fewer platform providers, there are still a lot of companies that perform those specialized services where there is growth or there is, you know, potential for growth, and that's especially in the cyber area. There's a lot more spending going into that area than there was 10 years ago. So you have a broader array of contractors. So that might be a way to describe, you know, that phenomenon. But certainly the number of platforms, it's way down over the years. There's little hope, you know, how many new air fighters do we need? And what's your development cycle? And how do you keep an industrial base so that you have that capability if you need it? And, you know, there'll be another generation of air fighters, jet fighters, but you just don't have that much in terms of production right now. Not compared to historically what we've had. Well, and especially since the end of Iraq and Afghanistan situation, we're not producing as much hardware as we needed to 5 years ago, 6 years ago.
So really we're looking at a situation whereas, you know, if watch a World War II movie, you see fighters, you know, the Fs, like the F-35s or whatever. You see bombers like the B for bombers 29. You have the P-51s. There are different kinds of airplanes going on, but now we're essentially just doing one platform to illustrate your point. But also there was something that really came up, Richard, that really disturbed me, and I thought it had broader implications. And I bless your heart for bringing it up. And that is that the U.S. defense contractors have pretty much stopped investing in capital equipment and in research and development. Can you explain that one to listeners? It's pretty chilling.
Well, this is just part and parcel of the financialization of our economy. If you look, there's been a lot of research as to what companies are investing and how much they're investing in those two areas, R&D and capital and equipment, and personnel and you know, hiring and labor, giving people basic raises. But most of the cash flow in the defense industry has gone, like most other industries, gone into stock buybacks and dividends. So it's gone back into, you know, boosting the stock price, which is what happens when you have a stock buyback. And that enables, you know, your executives to make more because a lot of their pay is in stock options. And then it drives up the cost of the share, so it keeps them looking good in the eyes of the shareholders. And in the defense industry in 2013, 83% of what was generated in cash was actually distributed as a dividend or used to repurchase stock. But last year in 2014, it went up to 102%. So they were actually taking money out of their company to give back to shareholders in the form of dividends and also to buy back their stocks. So they pushed up the price of their stock. They've done that. They've been successful in doing that. That's what a lot of companies have done. Even Apple has generated tremendous, tremendous cash. But that's been part and parcel, as I said, of the financialization of our economy. It's being driven, you know, and it's a cliche, but it's being driven by the top 1%, the people who own the capital and who live on investment income instead of workers. But it's been driven tremendously by the pressure of Wall Street for companies to perform and to have high share prices. And that's indicative of, you know, the whole economy, basically. It's being driven by that. Profits are still at record highs. Profits are extremely high. But they're just not being invested in R&D. This is a real concern among people. The money is not going into R&D in the defense industry. It's a very small amount. It's paltry. And it's true, too, throughout the whole industrial enterprise. The cash that is being generated is going back into shareholders by dividends and stock buybacks so that the price of the share goes up. And that's just what's driving our economy. There are a lot of people in the manufacturing sector who make products who are really frustrated by this. And certainly workers are, that they don't really understand it. They just know they're not getting raises, and they know that nobody's getting hired. So that's kind of what happens when you have a system that's run by the financial interests of the country rather than by, you know, the worker interests or the industrial interests. And we've got a political system that just caters to that.
Well, Richard, you use the term financialization. You know, really what it is the cannibalization of capitalism, because if you keep pulling money out for financial purposes, you know, at a rate of 102%, you know, you take a little here and a little there, you know, to kind of paraphrase Everett Dirksen, and pretty soon you're left with nothing.
That's the worry, is that, okay, so DOD used to drive these companies, and DOD used to drive technology. They drove the nuclear power industry, the aerospace industry. They drove the integrated circuit industry and semiconductors and software and big software systems and RISC processors, reduced instruction set processors, and supercomputing and graphical computing and global positioning services systems and internet. But now, what in the last 20, 25 years has come out of DOD? I mean, you can really ask that question technologists, and they'll have to scratch their head to try to come up with something, because I don't know. Can you? So now DOD is dependent, on autonomous vehicles. That's all being driven by the private sector, Google. Additive manufacturing, that's not being driven by DOD. So the new revolutionary technologies, they all came out of DOD over the last 60 years, 70 years, or maybe prior to the last 20. You know, now the question is, okay, so the DOD enterprise with their laboratories, tremendous long-term focus on research, basic research, applied research, drove so many of our basic industries, drove our technological development and created new industries. Now what's being created? Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat, I don't know. Jesus.
It is pretty bad. But I'll tell you what.
So that's a worry. That's a worry. And you said it exactly. So if you're not investing in long-term R&D, basic research, then, you know, where's your economy going to be in 12 years? So, again, you know, we got to get focused on the real issues, the important issues, which is exactly as you said, you know, real technology, real development, real ideas.
Richard, I tell you what, let's break for a commercial, because whenever we get back, I want to talk about this focus and talk a little bit more, a little bit conceptual about what we can anticipate if we continue on this path, if that would be okay. We're talking with Richard McCormick, who is with Manufacturing and Technology News, and you can find out more. I signed up for their newsletter today at manufacturingnews.com, and you're listening to him here on the Tim Danny Show, and we'll be right back.
The food that we eat, genetically altering seeds with deceit. Roundup is coming out in your urine. My brothers in prison are torturing urine.
Our government should be open. It must be accountable to the people. And we demand access to vote and our votes be counted and verified. These concepts should be common sense in our democracy, but they're not. Some would deny us these rights. But people died for them, and Common Cause works every day to make certain they did not die in vain. Join Common Cause. Keep your rights and hold political power accountable where it should be. The people. CommonCause.org. Holding power accountable.
Media is acting like they're unaware, while Obama and Romney from Wall Street debating, doing each other.
Welcome to this episode of the Tim Danhe Show's American History Minutes. In 1995, when the U.S. Senate was considering the United States as part of the World Trade Organization, Ralph Nader challenged every member of Congress to read the entire treaty and answer 10 simple questions in public. Nader asked because he saw no evidence that any congressman even read what was in the bill that would represent the greatest surrender of local, state, and national sovereignty in United States history. Of all the members of Congress, only Senator Hank Brown of Colorado had the fortitude to accept Nader's challenge. He read the World Trade Agreement, sat down in front of an audience and cameras, and correctly answered 12 questions. His response to actually reading the treaty? He said he believed in free trade, but he was stunned how the World Trade Organization was a threat to national sovereignty. No other member of Congress showed evidence of reading the bill, and Senator Brown went to his fellow senators and tried to tell them the trade agreement was bad for America. However, no one changed their vote. The U.S. became part of the World Trade Organization, and all our legislation that affects business and consumers is subjugated to the final authority of the World Trade Organization. The world's greatest deliberative body didn't even read the bill that surrendered our ability to freely make future laws. This American History Minute is brought to you by The Tim Danhe Show. Please like us on Facebook at Tim Danhe Show, follow us on Twitter at hashtag Tim Danhe Show, and listen to us at danhe.com.
We didn't care, 'cause we didn't know. We only saw what they chose to show. We got our kicks, we're not complaining. It's only news if it's entertaining. Oh, that was the week. That was the week.
Welcome back to the Tim Danhe Show here at Danhe.com, and it's just, I'm really enjoying this conversation with Richard McCormick. He's with Manufacturing and Technology News, and you can actually sign up for their emails at manufacturingnews.com. And really interesting information about industrialization and manufacturing and industrial policy versus financial interests in the United States, and it talks about it in the microcosm of the defense industry and the macrocosm of really the overall consequences of the actions that we take. And one of the actions that were taken, Richard, you know, it's been a fight, honestly, from my end, you know, as we try to get more and more people aware of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is just seems to have a life of its own. You cut off one head and it grows seven more, like some sort of mythic hydra. But the U.S. military, to their credit, you know, they're still in a Buy American mindset, and that's in your article. But now they're being criticized as dinosaurs in a world of globalization like car buyers were 30 years ago. Richard, if TPP passes, it's going to be illegal to use the phrase or emphasize Buy American as a matter of policy, right?
You know, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe you're right. I don't know what's in that thing.
Okay.
It's not been. Everyone's complaining about this lack of transparency, and that is completely true. We don't know what's in that damn thing. So there might be an amendment saying we can't favor American companies when we're using government procurement dollars. I know. There are so many rules like that, though, beyond just the TPP. You know, we just had this ruling about country of origin labeling for beef products and pork and poultry products, where the World Trade Organization ruled against Americans for requiring that country of origin labeling be on our meat products, because Mexico and Canada raised it with the WTO. So there are all these issues about these global issues about whether or not the means of commerce should be regulated by individual countries or by global courts or by these trade agreements. And the way it's going is that these trade agreements and the global commerce system is being more determined by rules set by international bodies than by individual countries. And that's a concern of a lot of people within the TPP. When that TPP is finally negotiated and released, people will have a chance to look at it. They'll have a chance to determine if that's the case. Hopefully there's a free and open debate. But I have to warn people about it, because I have looked at the trade agreements. I looked at NAFTA. I looked at PNTR, Permanent Normal Trade Relations with China. I looked at the Korea Free Trade Agreement and the CAFTA, the Central America Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA. I could not make heads or tails of any of that. I had no idea what was in them. It's all gobbledygook. If you look at the determinations, the rulings made by the World Trade Organization on disputes that are taken to the World Trade Organization, just as a journalist, I read these. I look at them. I can't make heads or tails. I don't know what they're... It's all a bunch of trade lawyer stuff. Americans are going to have really good trade lawyers representing their interests when these trade agreements, especially TPP, is finally released, because you will not be able to parse what the hell those words mean. I've looked at them. I'm like a wordsmith. This is my whole life. I can't make heads or tails out of that crap. And so we'll see when it comes out. And maybe lawyers will probably be able to figure it out and say, hey, this is what it means. But not until you get into that, you know, a court or an internal or a
tribunal.
Tribunal, will it be determined? So it'll happen when these cases are brought to these tribunals, and then Americans going to go, oh, what was that we signed up for?
Yeah.
But again, these things happen. I just mentioned COOL with country of origin labeling with meat products, and that happened. That was a big issue. It was an important issue among the people who are producing livestock and swine and poultry in this country. It didn't get out of that community. Americans didn't get upset. They didn't, start calling their congressmen and protesting and picketing. So I'm not sure. Americans seem to be distracted by crappy TV shows, and but these things are happening, and there's no reaction. And I think that's what the pro-TPP people are counting on, is Americans are just distracted, and they don't really rise up to the challenge or get mad.
There's
not much in the American people for fight anymore. They've just kind of given up. Say, that's the way it is. And that's the way it is. So the people who control the agenda, are controlling the agenda, and everybody else gets screwed and doesn't get a raise and has shit jobs. Oh, excuse me.
That's okay. It's internet radio. We can say that.
Yeah. So, you know, and can't get hired and, you know, on and on and on. But these issues are being raised, but they're just not generating any type of outcry, public outcry. And I think that's what the pro-trade forces are relying on, is they'll get their little thing in that trade agreement. You won't be able to figure it out, but they know it's in there. It'll be thousands of pages. You'll not be able to make heads or tails of it. It'll be all be couched in some legalese, and then everybody else kind of gets screwed.
Well, let me just make a couple notes here. That first of all, you know, during the commercial break, we plug in the commercials later after we record, and I'm going to put in a American History Minute that we do, and I have one about Hank Brown, and who is a former senator from Colorado, and there's a specific minute that we talk about his voting on the NAFTA. Back in the early 1990s. And then I'll also, we'll use the music today for the theme song, a song by a guy named Tom Nielsen called That Was the Week. And it'll talk about how Americans are so distracted. So, you know, you and I are talking the same. And if you ever wanted to talk about cool, I can go into all that. I've even written papers on that one. We get these issues out there. But, but Richard, let me bring it back here to the military, and I kind of was going through the logic on all of this. You know, we have international military production, and so guide me through this logic, if you could. If we're outsourcing our military purchases to foreign countries, right, and that means these foreign countries must be our allies, and if all of these countries, including China, are our allies and making our defense, who are we making these weapons to fight against?
I don't know. Martians?
Yeah, it makes no sense to me.
I think it's the Chinese. But we would. I mean, are we going to go to war with Chinese? The Chinese? Really?
Yeah.
That would be pretty.
Yeah,
North Koreans. I don't know.
I don't know who we're fighting, and I don't know who we're defending ourselves against. You know,
I guess ISIS. You know,
well, you never know. They could get in their 50 caliber machine guns on the back of Toyotas and somehow put them on ferry boats and cross the Bering Straits, I guess. But no, I know there's a bigger picture, but we seem to be coming up with increasingly petty militaries to fight against.
And we can't seem to beat them, you know?
Yeah, and then, you know, it strikes me as being like James Madison, you know, countries that are in a perpetual state of war can no longer expect to be free. You know, it's really kind of a sad situation on many different fronts. But Richard, we got to get you back on the show. We got to get you back on here more often as issues and schedules allow. I've thoroughly enjoyed this. I think you're addressing some vital and patriotic points, economic points, and really things that are necessary for the long-term success of the United States. I commend you for your outstanding work.
Thanks. I hope more Americans get engaged. You know, we just need millions and millions of people to, you know, get engaged.
Well,
turn off the boob tube and let people know that you're concerned about this stuff.
Well, maybe what we need to do is make it a sport. You know, we can just say, okay, this week the bankers beat the Americans 2-0. However, you know, next week the Americans are going to be throwing a new legislation at them or something and turn it into a score, because maybe that's how we get everybody to be relate to the forces at hand. But
well, you know, so I don't want to belabor any of this, but maybe it is a sport, and you're just seeing it played out in the streets of Baltimore. You know, we're just not, and in Ferguson, where there's been total deindustrialization of these communities and cities, and there it is. It's It's right in our faces. It's every night. We can't spend any money. We don't have any money for infrastructure, and we've got this crazy political system that's just not working at all because we're not generating wealth enough for the society. So we're seeing it every night. It's a sport on the TV.
Yeah, we're having kind of a off-topic conversation and casual, and I like it. But people don't realize what NAFTA has done to other countries too. It's taken away our jobs, but Mexico, it has destroyed the rural economies. It has destroyed small businesses throughout Mexico. Canada, if it wasn't for oil, and even oil is a fickle carrier of a nation's economy, but all of these countries that are within these trade agreements, none of them are benefiting to a great deal by them. And so all of these countries, whether it be in the Middle East, whether it be in Central America, even in the United States, where you get lack of economic opportunity, where people just want to, have an equal opportunity, they just want to raise their families, they just want to live in peace and have a basic sense of justice existing in their lives, you take that away through these trade agreements and consolidation and bigness and no wonder the global index for discontent is off the charts in every country, including the United States.
Yeah, and people just have to get engaged. We need Americans engaged, not disengaged, and that could change. It can change quickly and forcefully, and for the good. If people were engaged.
I like that, and we'll do that. Richard McCormick of Manufacturing and Technology News. You can find out more at manufacturingnews.com. I want to thank you for coming on the Tim Danhey Show. I enjoyed that.
Thank you much. Take care.
It's been an honor. You too. Okay, when we come back, a couple quick notes I want to talk about Amazon and something's going on at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and both are almost farcical. So you're listening to the Tim Danhey Show. We'll be right back.
Shell kills the Ogoni, there's blood in its oil. Texaco's burning a forest to spoil.
Why? Why do you send your food money to faraway factory farms and industrial ranchers distributing through megastores headquartered in other cities, other states? It doesn't make sense. You can keep your dollars local. Help your local farmer, your local rancher, your local retailer, your neighbors. And it comes back. Your commitment to the local food shift means more money stays in the community and is reinvested here, reinvested in you. It's easy and it's smart. Go to localfoodshift.com. Learn how to buy local and watch it grow here. Localfoodshift.com.
Bovine growth hormone is milk in the public, but that was the week. Kardashians for lovesick, that was the week of corporate crime.
Welcome back to the Tim Danhey Show here at Danhey.com. And again, I want to thank Richard McCormick of manufacturingnews.com for being a guest on the show. We're going to have him back. He's got some good stuff. I wanted to just report on a couple other things before we call it a day. Amazon. One of my favorite companies on earth. They're in trouble now because, as you know, the European Union, their antitrust regulators are investigating Amazon for their tax minimizing arrangements with Luxembourg. Apparently, Luxembourg has a tax shelter, which U.S. companies operating in Europe say, all right, we'll base out of Luxembourg. And what we'll do is avoid all the taxes. We'll take advantage of Luxembourg. Well, all the countries in Europe are getting furious with people like Google and Starbucks and Apple and Amazon. And so Amazon has come out and out of the goodness of their heart said that they are going to now start to comply with the various tax revenues in all the various nations in which they operate. Meaning that if you're working in Germany, what they're going to do is book the revenue in Germany. If they're selling in France, they're going to book the revenue in France, and they will comply with the various tax laws in those various countries rather than booking all of their revenue in Luxembourg and avoiding a boatload of taxes and making the people all over Europe not receive any benefits from the profits earned by Amazon, Apple, Google, and Starbucks and others operating in Europe. Europe. So I'm glad to see that Amazon is going to change their practices, but I'm even happier that the nations of Europe are putting their feet down and trying to crack down on this tax evasion, which is occurring on a widespread basis. The last story that I want to mention is that there are a few weeks ago, I did a story, actually it might even be a month or two ago, I did a story about where is Mary Jo White, and she's the head commissioner for the Securities and Exchange Commission, and saying with a stroke of her pen, she could make it so all corporations disclose how much the corporations contribute to campaign financing, to political candidates, but she doesn't do it. And Obama doesn't force her to do it. So some former SEC officials of both parties, Republican and Democrat, wrote a letter to the SEC saying, please make corporations disclose it. You could do it so easy. The people that are asking them to do it are William Henry Donaldson, who is the 27th chairman of the U.S. SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. He's a Republican. He served from 2003 to 2005. A guy named Arthur Levitt, who is a 25th chairman of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. He served from 1993 to 2001. He's a Democrat. And Bevis Longstreth, who is the 60th commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He served from 1981 to 1994. He was a Democrat. And these people are putting their foot down. They're saying, hey, it's time to make corporations do it. So really the question is, President Obama and Mary Jo White, why aren't you doing it? You could. It's fair. It's legal. And you don't. So praise to the three former SEC commissioners for getting involved and not just mildly going into silent retirement. You're speaking up for what's right for America. And we are happy to bring that forward here. On the Tim Danhey Show, we'll be back tomorrow. And I thank you for being with us.
That was the week voting rights were suspended. That was the year civil liberties ended. Oh, that was the week. That was the year. Those were the stories we didn't hear. That was the week. That was the week. That was the week.